Thing of Channel 2, right, and a continuation of the talk after supper, Monday the 8th of December 69, Monday the 8th of December 69, beginning of Channel 2, right, beginning of Channel 2, right, continuation of the talk after supper, Monday the 8th of December 69, beginning of Channel 2, right, Monday the 8th of December 69.
Okay, she got back to doc.
Well, she was dragging us to the duck for some reason, and we went up the steps, and the duck's got a bow window, and it's usually so crowded, especially after the theater gets out, that there's no standing room. I mean, no room. You just get in a press. And I saw somebody, Trudy, I think it was, said there's what's his name? I forget what his name was. Peter. And Elaine says, "Where?" And Trudy goes, "Oh, my God." And in the window. And so we kind of glanced up there. And he glanced out. He saw Elaine. And when we went in, he was back in a crowd of his friends with Graham. Graham had the reputation of looking like Jesus Christ, heavy beard and long hair and soft eyes, and he was the kindest soul I ever met, but so mixed up with pot and between his pot and his bitter. He didn't stand much of a chance. And he thought he could play guitar, and he couldn't. He kept wanting somebody to be an agent for him. And, of course, he couldn't find an agent because he couldn't play guitar. But he was one of this boy's friends. And they were back in the corner, sort of in a huddle. And Elaine forces her way through the crowd and breezes up through. She loved to breeze up to people, all her height.
Oh, did she?
But she couldn't very well manage it in the duck because there wasn't a lot of room to breathe, and she needed a lot of room. But just as early as she could, she went up to them and started off the conversation with, "Peter, why haven't you come out? You promised you'd come out to the farm." Well, he had promised. He'd been out at a party, and he had been so drunk that he had made the mistake of telling Elaine that he liked her. He never would have made the mistake if he'd been sober. He was so drunk that any girl that came along, he was willing to put an arm around and dance with. And Elaine had thought he meant it. She thought he meant it up to the day he disappeared, driven out completely. I'm not joking. And she was so funny. But we were walking along the street one day, and there was a tall blonde boy about, 100 or so yards up the street. She said, "There's Peter." I said, "No, Elaine, that's not Peter. It doesn't even look remotely like him." "Yes, it is. It's Peter." "No, Elaine, it doesn't even look remotely like him, Elaine. It's about 2 heads higher, and it doesn't walk like him. It didn't even built like him." But she would insist it was him. And just take it. You know, after all, she could have been mistaken the first glance. Another time, about a week later, we were walking down the street, and she says, "There he is." "Who?" "Peter, he's over there." I swear the boy was a brunette. Elaine, it's a brunette. I mean, you know, brown hair, and Peter has blonde hair. And she says, "Oh, I guess I made a mistake." And yes. And then she'd want to go to the duck, just on the chance she'd meet him. Finally got so that they never went to the duck anymore. I swear. We stopped going after a while, but not before she'd get us in there on one thing or another. And I guess it was a period of about 6 weeks when she didn't even see him. And she finally she stopped talking about him. And then we stopped going. We started going over to Hampton Lucy every week instead. Much nicer at Hampton Lucy.
Yeah, now Hampton Lucy is the one you liked. That's the place you like, the village.
Yeah, I liked Hampton Lucy. I couldn't stand the duck because the duck was so crowded. And one time we went in there and we was crushed into a corner and I just got so nervous I got up and walked out. I couldn't take it. I was very, very tired and I didn't want to come there. Lane had dragged us in. I hadn't wanted to come at all. And I sat there and shivered for, I don't know, it was after an evening performance and it was much more crowded than usual. And I just sat there and shivered and finally got up and walked out. It's about the worst I guess I've ever been in a crowd.
You just had the willies.
Willies, I was shook. And at Hampton Lucy it wasn't crowded. One night Margaret and Anne and I decided we were going to walk over to Hampton Lucy.
Okay.
And it was about 2.5 miles. And we started off, and we were in high good humor anyway. And we walked over there. We decided we'd cut across the fields.
And that is old loudmouth Margaret.
That's old loudmouth Margaret and loud Anne. Anne was loud, too.
Canadian Anne?
Yeah, when she was in good spirits. She's either very, very quiet or very, very gay and loud. What she called being spastic.
Yeah.
And we were all in a good mood. We started off over there and we got lost. We decided we cut across the fields, and we didn't realize we kept running into hedges and ditches, you know, great big ditches. And we'd have to go around the edge of the field to find the gap. And it was a miracle when we finally landed out on the Hampton Lucy Road. After struggling through a couple of hedges, and I don't know, we finally ended up on Hampton Lucy Lane, and walked the last few hundred yards to the pub, and it was cold that night, real brisk, and we'd start out just after dark, so we got there about 7:30. 8 o'clock, and we settled ourselves in the corner, and there was a little chap behind the bar who had gotten to know us, and he was really nice to us. He'd talk to us and small talk, you know, and chat, and we ordered a round of cider and sat there and just talked. It was about one of the best talks I ever had with Margaret. And they had another round of cider. And by the time we left, Anne and Margaret were both drunk. And
on cider?
On cider, sure. That rough cider's potent stuff. That'll hit you like vodka. One moment you don't know you've drunk it, and the next moment you do. And see, Anne and Margaret drank a lot more than I did. I wouldn't have more than a pint, usually. And I drink slow anyway. And I had I just didn't want to get drunk. I was having a great time just watching them. And that trip home was the most entertaining trip I ever had. We walked back. And both Anne and Margaret were so gay. Neither one of them could walk straight down the road. And we came out of this warm pub. They would have been pleasantly, but they hadn't been noisy in the pub. They'd been quiet in the pub. And it all been about nice and cozy, beautifully cozy. And just the nice, congenial atmosphere and the chatty barman and the easy. We spent a long time just sitting there. We didn't leave until about 9 o'clock. And we got out on the road, and the cold air hit them. And they were singing and run down the road, and then Ann would stop, and she'd say, "What if somebody comes down the road?" And Margaret would say, "Well, I have to go into the hedge." And Ann would say, "Yeah, that's what we'll have to do." I'm scared to death somebody was going to drive down the road and pick them up. And I was walking. I was watching them half the time, and the sky the other half, because it was clear. And this gorgeous sky. And walking down the lane in that cold weather. And those two idiots on a roll.
On cider.
On cider.
Rough cider.
Rough cider. Yeah, ninepence cider. None of your 1 and 3 stuff. And a car came along, and Margaret grabbed hold of me and says, "Quick, we gotta hide in the hedge." And she dragged me off into the hedge, into the ditch. And Ann jumped behind a tree. And this poor old car. They'd seen us. They couldn't help but seen us. These long straight lanes, and they didn't decide they were gonna have to get off and hide. And the car was practically on top of them. So. What a good it did. Except to make the people who were in the car wonder what the heck was going on. Fortunately, we only met about 2 cars, because I got kind of tired. I got grabbed and dragged off into the hedge. And then we got into the top pasture. It was fabulous walk. The weather was so clear, and I felt good. I guess maybe a pint of cider might have had something to do with it, but I wasn't gonna give it too much credit. And we got up to the top of the field, and Ann said, "Oh, I remember. Somebody's got to get the milk." And Margaret said, "Yeah, that's right." And Ann says, "I can't. We might meet Mrs. Tilk." Margaret says, "Yeah, we can't meet Mrs. Tilk." And they looked at me and they said, "Barbara, you're sober. You go get the milk." So they went. I cut across and I saw them. And they got started, and it's a steep hill. You see, Pampton Lucy Lane's at the top of the hill. It's where they park that truck for the library.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I cut across to go down the side closest to the house, and they went straight on down. And they got onto the hill, and Ann started running, and Margaret started running. And pretty soon the momentum of the hill got to them, and they ended up in a file down at the bottom of the hill. And Ann just yelling at the top of her voice. Anybody who had heard her could have, I mean, you know, would have known just the way she would half sing her words, just how drunk she was. And they picked themselves up and toddled on into the stable and down to their rooms. And those trips into the hedges messed them up a little bit. And I went in and got the milk and took it down. And doggone if there wasn't somebody in the club room. And what we really wanted was for that club room to be empty. I can't think of it. No, Emmy, it was empty. And we all met back in the club room and sat around with some coffee and talked some more. And Margaret and Ann still they were still happy, but they were in a presentable state by the time the other kids came back, because they brought some friends with them. And they were in a fairly presentable state by then. You know, they weren't talking quite the same way they'd been talking on the road. Oh, that was a gay night.
That's the end of the little session after supper on Monday night, the 8th of December, 69. This is Channel 2 Right, 170. Channel 2 Right, 170. And the end of the little session after supper, Monday, the 8th of December, 69, while we're waiting for the president's press conference. And now, Faye and Barbara have gone down the front lane to stretch and ease. Faye was wiggling all this time, and I told her to go on down the lane, and Barbara said she'd go with her. And that would be right fitting after this trip to Hampton Lucy, that beautiful trip, the three of them, with that rough cider at 9p a pint. None of this 1 in 3 stuff, Barbara says. Channel 2 Right, 180 now. Channel 2 Right, 180.
This is Tuesday after supper, the 9th of December. Tuesday after supper on the 9th of December. What is it? This is Tuesday, the 9th of December after supper. Tuesday, the 9th of December after supper. Tuesday, the 9th of December after supper. Channel 2 Right, round 185. Channel 2 Right, around 185. Channel 2 Right, about 185. Miss Parker, yeah.
Now that's another sign of her. She, Miss Parker?
She would catch me in the club room sometimes when I was in for a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And she would insist on telling me how what a cultured youth she'd had. When she was a girl, there had been, her family had been so cultured, and she had all these fabulous books that her family had left her, some of which were in museums. They were such valuable pieces that she had loaned them to museums. And she had some furniture that were heirlooms left her by her. They come down through the family and were hundreds of years old, and other pieces that she had let go at the, you know, during the year she had let them go. And the family home was supposed to be some beautiful old house in Hertfordshire. But she couldn't believe any of it. She used to talk about her sons and what fine boys they were, and how one of them had immigrated to Australia, and the others were working and supporting their family and all this sort of thing. And she said, don't believe it. The one that immigrated to Australia had to do it because he was trying to get away from the law. And the other two boys don't contribute a penny for their mother. They just, she's lucky if she sees them. She was sensitive. Now she used to get in fights with Judy, because Judy, she said, would treat her as a servant, and she'd get in big fights, and she called Judy a snob, and talked about what high touty friends Judy had and how she wouldn't associate with the students. And the only reason, one of the reasons Judy wouldn't come down to the stable was because Mrs. Parker was there. There was a grain of truth in it. There was usually a little bit of truth in anything Mrs. Parker said. That's why you could be taken in by her.
Yeah. You wanted to kind of go along with her?
Yeah, especially if you didn't like the people she was talking about anyway. It was handy.
Yeah.
It was handy. Yeah. And when she talked about Mrs. Tilk, she would say, she would always talk about her come, she'd say, "Now, if you ever need any help, I'll make up your bed for you, because if Mrs. Tilk comes down, she brings her book with her, and she gives you black marks for every little thing that is wrong. And she'll check them off, and then if you get so many black marks, you get in trouble." And then Mrs. Tilk, of course, would be feeling bad and be in a bad mood and be cranky about something, and that would just back it up. She would come down occasionally, and if there was something wrong, well, she would mention it to Mrs. Parker, and Mrs. Parker would blow it up.
Oh.
You see, as she came in and she took one look at the floor, and she saw cigarette ashes. You girls treat this place as a public saloon. You just leave cigarette ashes all over the place and expect me to clean it up. And Mrs. Tilk was furious. She, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to be in serious trouble. She's got eyes like a hawk. She can see anything. She stood in that doorway and saw those cigarette ashes over there.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. This is what Mrs. Parker said.
Well, that sounded like she had a gift.
Certainly, I was never the object of one of her little explosions. See, she really exploded 3 times that I know of.
Erupted,
yeah.
In Mark Lane, too.
Yeah. First time, I was within hearing of one, but not the worst part of it. I wasn't within hearing of the worst part of any of them. The first was with Judy. When she met Judy on the yard and accused Judy was being a bit high-handed trying to get rid of her, and she accused Judy of being a snob, and Judy, being just as fiery as Mrs. Parker, said that Mrs. Parker was nothing but a low, dirty old woman, and Mrs. Parker was, in a loud voice, accused her of being a, well, I don't know, snob, and she must have been a bit stronger than that, and certainly she was loud and forceful enough. And Judy went storming up to the house. When Judy was mad, she had a way of storming up to the house. She'd walk up the drive with her back stiff. And she went up to the house and told her mother that Mrs. Parker had been insolent and she just couldn't stand her. And so Mrs. Parker went roaring up to the house to tell Mrs. Tilt what a snob her daughter was.
Poor Mrs. Tilt.
Mrs. Tilt was looking for some way to get rid of Mrs. Parker, but couldn't figure out how to do it. And Mrs. Thornett was highly amused by the whole thing.
Oh, she was?
Oh, yes. I can just see her standing in the kitchen with her arms folded, leaning against the sink and watching the whole thing.
Well, you mean you can just see her?
Well, I didn't see her.
You didn't?
No. But I can imagine what she looked like. And I know how she talked about it later.
Yeah.
Casual references.
Oh.
She caught Trudy, and there were cigarette ashes. Trudy was terrible about dropping cigarette ashes. She just simply smoked and never saw that there's an ashtray.
Is that right?
It is this marvelously delicate, cultured girl. And I don't think she knew that ashtrays had been invented.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Parker knew that Trudy was one of the worst offenders on this. She caught her in the club room one day and was furious. I guess she'd gotten it from Mrs. Tilt because the kitchen was so dirty. Well, she kept the kitchen a pigsty, but that was another matter. And she caught Trudy in the club room and called her a filthy swine, told her that she had never seen such dirty girls as this whole entire group of students was, and that Trudy was the worst, and said that we all treated the place as if it was a public room with servants to pick up after us, and that she was no servant of ours, and that Trudy was, several times she called her a filthy pig or something like that, really strong. And Trudy came away in tears. She couldn't go storming up to Mrs. Tilt because we all thought Mrs. Tilt was on the other side. And the last thing Trudy would do would be to go and say anything to Mrs. Tilt. And so Mrs. Parker won the day on that one. And then before she left, just before Christmas, was when we had that night when Trudy and Anne both got drunk. Hopelessly, helplessly drunk. And Trudy was so remorseful. And upset by it. But Anne never minded getting drunk. And the next day when Mrs. Parker went in, Anne's room was a mess. And she came storming out and she found Anne and she said, "If you think that I am going to clean up after some drunken little scallywag," and Anne's son took about 5 steps backwards and said, "Well, I intended to clean that up. I didn't ask you to go in there." But Mrs. Parker was on a full sail. She would come. She was a great, big, hefty, wide woman, and she came sailing down the yard, just trying to find anybody she could talk to tell them how horrible, what a terrible girl Anne was, what a drunken little brat she was. Anne, of course, was fiery and got mad at her and told her off. And Celia, this is one instant that marked Celia up several marks in my book, was the way she handled it. And she managed to get Mrs. Parker and Anne separated. And she taught Mrs. Parker was vowing and declaring that she was, "I'm not going up to Mrs. Tilt, but if you say another word to me, I'll report this to her." And she came sailing up to me and she said, "I don't know what happened last night, but I'm certainly not going to clean up after it. I think it's ridiculous for people to expect me to clean up after them." And I said, "Well, I don't think anybody did." And she said, "Well, I don't know. If it worked for girls like you, I'd report this to Mrs. Tilk immediately, because anybody she was talking to was her best friend, and anybody she was talking about was the worst thing she." And she went storming off. I don't know, into the club room, and Celia had Anne down in the cage boxes, and Anne was furious. She was crying with rage. And Celia told her, "Look, I don't care, I don't mind that you got drunk. You didn't hurt anybody. It's your business whether you want to get drunk or not, as long as you don't go destroying property, doing something that's going to hurt the school or something. But you should have gotten your room straight before you came out on the yard. I knew what happened last night. And it was your responsibility to get that room straight before you came out on the yard." And if you want to get drunk, that's fine with me, but you take care of yourself. Throw responsibility on other people. And Ann said, Drew, so that's why I was going to clean it up. She didn't have to go in there. I never told her to go in there. She says, well, I know how much you dislike Mrs. Parker. I know how much I dislike her. But that's not the point. Now, I'll take care of her. You just go in and straighten your room up. Mm-hmm. And Ann did. And Celia took care of Mrs. Parker. And Mrs. Parker went into a slow simmer. It never got up to the house unless what I don't think Celia ever mentioned it. But grand morning, it really was, from somebody's point of view.
Looks to me like you missed Miss Parker when she left.
Oh, Judy.
But Judy couldn't erupt. She wasn't an old hand at it like Miss Parker.
Judy was the one that did erupt.
You never said anything about Judy erupting. You said she was numb.
I'm sure I have.
Did you say it?
Well, I know what she said to me.
Well, that was just a catty remark.
Well.
You wouldn't call that erupting.
Maybe not. But then there were the fights with Celia on the yard.
With Judy? I mean...
Judy and Celia. About once every month or so. And generally ended with with Judy walking, storming up to the house. One pretext or another.
Yeah. And they were full scale?
Oh, yeah. They were full scale.
Yeah. And full voice?
And full voice.
Right on the open.
Mm-hmm.
Public.
It always ended, it was always a fight about Corey, Celia's horse.
Oh.
But it was just an excuse. In other words, the words were all about Corey. but the fight was about almost anything else that happened. happened.
Right?
Yeah. Usually, for instance, Celia would say something about how the place was, something about management.
Yeah.
And Judy would say, well, take care of it yourself. Didn't matter what it was. I mean, it might have been taking care of the books, which was Judy's job. But if Celia mentioned something to her, it was take care of it yourself. And since it was always these conferences started while Celia was working on Corey in Corey's box, the next statement, well, I'm busy, I'm working with my horse. You're always working with your horse. Why can't you go out and do a little work? And it usually took place just before Celia's. It usually took place on a Saturday morning, just before Judy's lesson. Judy had a 10:30 lesson on Saturday morning. With these children had all of them had ponies. They were old hands around the stable, all of them, perfectly used to Judy and everything about it. And Judy would either storm into her office and close the door and fume, or she would storm up to the house to go get changed. And if she was in the office, it was dangerous to go in and talk to her. I remember one time I was heading for the office door about something. I said, Judy in there? And the child says, yes, but I wouldn't go in. And I sort of said, oh. And she says, yeah.
Well, we'll cut it off here on this long, rainy day. Barbara stayed in all day. Faye worked all day. I got Reel 3 off in the mail and went to a staff meeting. And Kenny Sims is out of the barber business, at least temporarily. This is Channel 2, right, 420, after supper, Tuesday, the 9th of December, 69. After supper, Tuesday, the 9th of December, 69. Channel 2, right, 425. This is Wednesday night after supper, the 10th. Wednesday night after supper, the 10th of December, after that tornado of sort of a storm we had this morning, daybreak. And this solitaire singer we got in a paper edition. It's Wednesday after supper, the 10th of December, 69. It's Channel 2 right around 4:30. Channel 2 right around 4:30.
Well, this was a real exciting day for me because Barbara had made a discovery about a ride that she wanted to take me on. And she told her mother over the telephone she's going to take me on this ride.
Yes, I remember
that. And awake the next morning, that was a week ago, and it was pouring rain, and we didn't get to go. And last night I said, Barbara, let's just take that ride in the morning. They had already said that it's going to be, sun was coming out. And when we got up this morning to a tornado, it looked like it was all over. After we fed, there was a break in the sky, and Barbara and I said, let's go. A real thing to do. Now, I want you just tell about that. Right? It was that gate, wasn't it, that was open?
The gate?
Yeah.
Over there?
Yeah. And I had told Bob about riding on the back of Tuscarora. I knew, but it was the gate that made it exciting.
The horse is called.
And the line and That bit that you had me ride, Missy, I believe that helped me as much as anything. Because I'll tell you what, you can't pleasure ride with that double reins. I don't think. And when you've got a single rein and a bit like that, you can, it makes a lot of difference. Is that right?
No.
It did to me.
I suppose.
I never knew a horse would talk as you ride along in the woods.
You know, this is Saturday the 13th of December, and Suzanne and Barbara were out all day on the country looking at horses. Saturday the 13th of December, 69, Channel 2 right, 460.
We thought we'd come back.
Yeah.
And we'd have, you know, we were going to, when we left Ocala,
yeah,
we thought we'd come back and just straight on back. And I thought, well, I can't not stop by Mike Tilton's and see Mr. Hetherington or Faye will have my head.
Yeah.
So I stopped by Mike Tilton's and we didn't get away from there till 3.
Yeah, because you all said you were going to get back in before.
Yeah.
Well, I figured you'd be back here by the middle of the morning. I didn't know you were going to be out on the county all day.
Yeah, I kept saying, well, you know, with those two spirits, you know they're having a good time. And I knew that, too, and I knew you'd found, with all those farms, you'd found something. It wouldn't take you very long to find it. Well, where'd you go first?
Well, we went into the Ocala saddle shop.
Oh, that's, yeah.
We just went straight on in, and Suzanne and I sort of shopped around, and I found some saddle pads I bought. And then I went up to the fellow that was, I wanted to get his wife, because she's chatty.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, she'll talk.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and I knew it would be easier to get something out of her than to, then to talk to him.
Yeah.
Where that saddle shop.
Mm-hmm. And I just feel easier about doing it than I talking to him.
Yeah, she is nice.
But I was rather surprised. They've got in a whole stock of English.
Oh.
They have a lot of English stuff. And so I spent a lot of time just looking around.
Mm-hmm.
And finally I took my three little saddle pads over to him and paid for them. I said, by the way, I'm looking for Hunter and Jumper people, and I think the name was Harrison out on Shady Lane. And he said, well, no, that couldn't be the right name. And I said, well, I tell you, I'm just visiting the area, and I'm really just looking for anybody that works with Hunters and Jumpers.
Yeah.
I said, well, I can't think of anybody. Let me ask my wife. So he went over, and she was standing there, and he says, you know, who is it out on Shady Lane? Hunters and Jumpers. And I told her, I pointed my question at her, and she said, well, the Clarks. She says, yeah, but somebody with a riding school, and she said, some other name. And then she said, oh, and Snyder.
Oh.
Snyder's. And he says, yes, the Snyder's, I know them. And he was trying, he said that name first, and then he said to find the riding school, because Snyder doesn't have a riding school, he has a stable. And we went, he told us how to get out to the Shady Lane, and then he told us how to get to Snyder's. And Suzanne knew. She said, do you know where the Geno's discount is? And I said, no. And I do. So he told her how to get there. And we went out in the car and cranked it up and headed down past the discount house and figured we missed our turn. We were trying to figure it out. Now, he said the road right past the discount house. And there was a road that ran sort of parallel. And then there was the road that ran off that to the right. And we figured, well, we'd stay on 441 and take the first right turn off 441. And so we did. We turned down it. And we figured, well, we're as lost as we can be anyway. Because we were sure that it wasn't the right road.
Yeah.
And I said, Suzanne, did he tell you the name of the road? And she said, yes, it's West Anthony. I said, all right. Well, look, there's a stop sign right on down there. We just drive down there and see what road we're on. And we drove down there, and the road that we were crossing was West Anthony.
Oh, really?
It was real confusing. We couldn't, you know, it was hard to figure out. But so we turned down, and we drove about 3 miles, looking for this place on the left with Spanish architecture. And I don't know what I was expecting, something in white. And I was expecting something rather big and impressive, but not anything like what was actually there. We drove on it was 3 miles, and, you know, after the first mile, we were kept looking for the doggone thing. But finally, we kind of sort of came around a curve, and down the road there was a pale orangish house, definitely in Spanish architecture, but very modern.
Uh-huh.
Very modern, and not very big, but very, very, very new, and sort of swanky looking. And right next to it, across a paddock and a drive, there was about a 5-stall stable built in that same architecture, the same stone and everything. And fancy, just fancy doors and all of it looking so new, you know.
Yeah.
And all the fencing was that creosote, dark wood. Now, this is the place, all right. So we turned in and we drove up to the stable, and there was nothing but a black dog who told us to go away. He said, go away, very definitely. And we didn't see anybody. So we thought, Suzanne says, well, look, we'll just drive over to the house. And I said, yeah, all right. We'll drive over to the house. So she turned around, and we drove over to the house and didn't see anybody. And I couldn't get nerve up enough to get outside of the car. And she said, and we were sort of sitting there discussing whether there was anybody home or not. And she says, oh, look, there's somebody up in that field up there. And I said, where? I don't see anybody. She says, well, he's gone behind a tree now, but there's somebody up there.
That's Suzanne.
Yeah.
She moves.
And I said, all right, well, look, we'll go talk to him. So we drove way on, went back, drove past the stable, and drove on up to the hay barn. They have a hay shed that's way on back. And we drove up there, and just about that time, this car turned around and started driving back towards us. And I said, well, I don't know what the heck I'm going to say to him. And she says, well, you can just say you're interested in hunters. I said, I'll just tell him the truth. She says, well, yeah, that might work. You are interested in hunters.
That's too bad. It's good she's alone.
I wouldn't have gone in the place if she hadn't been alone. I just have no nerve. I wouldn't have gone in. If I'd seen there wasn't anybody right there,
uh-huh.
I would have lost my nerve before I could have made it all the way up there. So she rolled down a window, and this little fellow in the car, white hair and eyes like Santa Claus, blue eyes that just twinkle, and I took her a little and I said, Mr. Snyder? And he says, yes.
Oh, really?
I said, I'm Barbara Long from North Carolina, and I'm so interested in hunters, and I heard that you raised some real nice ones. And he was business. He said, well, what sort do you want? I said, I've only got some young horses over here. They might be too young for what you're interested in. I said, well, no, I'm not really looking, buying right now, but I'm interested in young horses. And he says, well, get out and I'll show you what I've got right here. Because there was a field on both sides of them. And he got out and he took us over and he showed us his yearlings. Now I've got this black mare, she's thoroughbred, and gray mare, gray filly, she's thoroughbred. Got jumpers on both sides, and real nice horse. I expect to get a good price for her. And he showed us quarter horse filly, that and some other. Oh, he went every horse in the field. He showed us and told us about, and gave us sire and dam, and what he expected it to do. And all of this was really business.
Oh.
You know, I was a potential buyer. And he asked me sort of what time. Then he was talking about he'd been up in Virginia, and when he'd give the history of the horse, he'd say, now, for instance, I can't remember. Suzanne would remember this better than I was because I was a little too keyed up. She could remember it better than I could.
Oh.
But he was pointing to Palominas. He said, now, I've raised a lot of Palominas for a woman out in California. She wants me to get a thoroughbred Palomino. And we sell them over to Germany and England. They like them. And he was pointing out a couple of the horses. He says, now, I used to be up in Virginia. And I raised the horses up there, and then I came down here. And he started asking me if I knew several people. And I knew of some of them. I didn't know others. But I sort of said, after he was talking about another horse, and then I sort of said, well, you know Bill Daly? He said, yeah. Yeah,
oh,
I know Bill Daly.
Barbara.
Says, I used to have a farm right outside of Middleburg, real right close to the Sears farm where he was managing. I said, just let it drop, and he talked about horses some more, and he went back, showed us. Everything we did was just this way. We'd talk about horses, and he'd show me a horse, and he'd give me his history, and then there'd be this one line, one-liners all the way through. It was really interesting. It was horse trading.
Yeah.
So we went in, and he showed me a chestnut filly, weanling, this year's crop. And she was pretty. And I sort of had my eye on her, and I sort of said, well, you know, how much are you expecting to get for her? And he said, well, now, I've got this filly and another one, her full sister, I sold her full sister up to Virginia last year in a crop of foals. Training stable up in Virginia bought a whole consignment, bought all my weanlings. They bought about 30 horses in me and all, and they just took all my weanlings for training. And her sister is doing real well. And he seemed to get completely off the subject. She's doing real well now, and I've got these two colts over here. I've got another filly here, this filly. I've only got two fillies left, and this filly is real nice, and he showed me this other filly. And almost as if he'd forgotten what I was going to say, what he was asking. And then he sort of circled back, and he talked about how this training stable picked up his whole whole crop of weanlings the year before. And he says, now, get back to the point. I think last year, her full sister brought me something I think he gave me the price for the whole crop of weanlings, six weanlings, $25,000. And he said that was six. There were six in that crop, mm-hmm. And some of them weren't thoroughbred. Some of them were three-quarter bred or mixtures. And he said, "Now I expect to get maybe around $750 for this horse. This is as a weanling. Uh-huh. This isn't when she gets on any. This is as a weanling." And I thought, looked at her, she's pretty. Mm-hmm. She was pretty. She says, "Now she's got a lot of jumping on both sides. She's got a real good jump, and she moves well. I just don't keep a horse that doesn't move well." Uh-huh. And so then he took us down. He said, "Now a lot of these horses I use this thoroughbred sire I've got down here, Nashville sire. These Nashville bloodlines by out of Nashville. What's this? Noble? Something noble." I forget. The son is well known too. Yeah. I knew the name, but I'd forgotten. And he took me down to show it. It was a chestnut stallion. Oh, Faye, it's beautiful. And just as sweet. He just really nice tempered. Now, you see, Miss Davis wouldn't take us in anywhere close to first play.
No, she wouldn't.
And we just walked in with the stallion, and he grabbed hold of my coat. And he wouldn't let go. And I wasn't in any hurry. I just said, sort of let go. And we just kept on talking about horses and trying to get the horse to let go of my coat. And I wasn't going to get, I wasn't going to lose my temper about it or anything. And he's sitting there playing tug of war with my coat. And he was. Mr. Snotty didn't pay any attention. He's just talking, and he says, "And he's got a real nice temper, and all his colts come out bigger than he is, and they're real nice. They're just big, strong hunter types. Mm-hmm. And he's got all his colts can jump. And he was talking about." I couldn't keep up with him because he talked about so many. He'd talk about a mare, and he talked about her foal, mm-hmm. and how it was doing well. And then he'd talk about the stud, and it sired that foal, so that horse would come back into the conversation, but I couldn't pick it up. It's the same horse. I wasn't following very well. And Suzanne was following that. She was just hanging on that and picking that up.
Everything was so excited.
Yeah, she was just... She'd say, "Now, is that Palomino foal out of that stallion?"
Uh-huh.
And he'd say, "Yes, well, that's the sire of it." So he used this chestnut stallion to breed Palominos, too, because chestnut on a Palomino or chestnut on a sorrel,
uh-huh.
gets Palomino foal. And now let me see, where did the next one-liner come? Right about there. Oh no! Then he went over and showed us all the young horses, and talked about he had some horses that had been young Palomino colts.
Mm-hmm.
One of them he showed me, it was a horse that had it was the thoroughbred Palomino, really thoroughbred, and he was a stallion. And this man, he found him in Michigan someplace. This boy was wanting to race him, and he'd found this thoroughbred stallion. Of course, he grabbed him because there's just no such thing as a pure thoroughbred.
Yeah.
It's Palomino.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not an acceptable color in the thoroughbred mm-hmm. registry. So he got talking about Palomino breeding, you see. And he took me outside and he showed me another stallion, the Palomino stallion. Oh, it was a gorgeous stallion. He says, now this horse really moves well. And about that time, there was a gray mare just galloping up and down, showing off in the cold weather. And Suzanne said, oh, look, isn't she beautiful? He says, yes, that's my show prospect. He says, this horse is, I've kept her back. I could have sold her, but I didn't think it'd be fair because they put her in competition with older horses with more experience, because she's just gotten started. So I kept her back and didn't sell her. And what I want to do is to show her in a lot of little shows starting in around in January, and then I'll sell her when I've got her made. That's the way I like to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I said something about showing and dressage. He says, you interested in dressage? I said, I've done a little work with dressage. And he said, well then, come on, I've got something to show you. And he put, we'd been sort of following him around in Suzanne's car, but now he said, come on, get in my car and I'll show you something. So we piled into his car and he took us back up the hill, back up to the hay barn, and went around to a paddock back there, and he says, I've got an Andalusian stallion. Says he was bought by Mr. Courier. You know Mr. Courier? And just as easy, I'm supposed to know Mr. Courier.
Yeah.
Also supposed to know the Vanderbilts if they happen to be in the conversation. Anybody else that comes into the conversation. And I said, well, didn't really know. He says, well, he was over in Portugal, and he saw these horses bullfighting. I said, mm-hmm. And he said, and he fell in love with the breed, because he was very interested in dressage. He fell in love with the breed. And he bought this stallion and five mares. He paid $25,000 for the stallion and $5,000 apiece for each of the mares. And he got this stallion and brought it over to this country, and was going to breed Andalusians from him. And he just had started, what he discovered was that if you breed the stallion to a thoroughbred, you get that beautiful dressage horse with the thoroughbred movement that's preferred in this country, because the Andalusian moves too high in front. And it says about that time he and his family were flying to Bermuda, and they're in a private plane, and their plane just disappeared, and they never found anything. They don't know what happened to it. Says it was a big blow up in the papers. And the horses, nobody knew what was going to become of them, but they came up for sale. And I bought this stallion and two of his foals. And one of them I sold for a hunter, and the other I sold for a jumper, and I think he's been bought to be donated to the United States equestrian team. So he'll be on the USET pretty soon. He's just got a tremendous jump, just tremendous jump. So we got up there and he took us around, and sure enough there was this Andalusian stallion, white, standing over in one corner of the paddock. And he says, now I want you just watch him. And he took us in and he picked up a piece of moss to get the horse to go, and that horse fired up. And he says, now watch him, because he'll never stop facing me. And he chased him around the paddock a bit, and sure enough, that stallion just faced him every time. He says that he's had been trained for the bulls, and he's taught not to. See, the bullfighting from a horse like that is different from the bullfighting where you just take horses in for the picadillos,
yeah,
and that sort of thing. It's completely different. It's an art, and it's they try very desperately not to get their horses gored, because the horses are tremendously expensive animals.
Yeah.
And he said, you'd never believe he was that quick. And he was. He looked like, well, he looked like a Lipizzaner.
Uh-huh.
Except heavier. He had the same long, ugly head. I'm afraid Lipizzaners do not have beautiful heads. He had a long, ugly head. And mane all over the place. Just down. He said, when it used to be longer than this. So he used to reach all the way down to the end of his nose. And when we were working him, his mane reached the end of his nose and his tail touched the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, we've given him some work. He's done some dressage. And he said, I've had offers. I bought this horse intending to sell it to somebody for a dressage horse. And they couldn't buy it. Something fell through, I forget what. But he said, and so I feel I'm stuck with this horse now. But I've got a nibble, and that horse was running. I mean, Suzanne was standing there with her eyes just huge. He was really showing off. He was putting his nose on the ground and flinging his head up with all that mane going out in the air, and then he galloped, and he had this high action,
yeah.
You know, and he's sort of flinging himself forward,
mm-hmm.
with his front feet, and quick, just turn, just like that, like a better than quarter horses,
yeah.
just flip, and he was turned. He says, you never believe a horse that big and heavy could move like that, could you? And she says, oh. And he says, now this horse has got the best breeding of any Andalusian stallion in this country. So most of them don't have they don't have good straight hocks, and this horse does. And he shows. And he said, he's just gentle. You can put a snaffle bit on him and ride him around. He's fine. Just lovely. And if you breed him to a thoroughbred mare, he says, the results are just fantastic. Then we went back down, drove back down, and I mentioned something about riding. And he says, well, about riding in England. He wouldn't know where I'd been in England, and I told him. And he says, well, I want to show you this Palomino stallion again. Took us in there. He says, now watch how this horse moves. I've been told that this horse would make a really fabulous dressage horse. Just look, watch the way he moves. And he made him trot around a bit. And he was a beautiful horse, just beautiful. And he says, I've had offers for this horse as a dressage and exhibition horse, but he says, I think he'll do more good as a stallion.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't see him being moving around from place to place and all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'll do more good and be better off as a stallion rather than an exhibition horse, because this way he'll pass this. He says he's got the power to pass this movement on. His get habit.
Mm-hmm.
He says his full brother was a girl took him up to Virginia Potomac Riding Center and had him just with a few months of training put him in an elementary dressage competition up there that was judged by Robert Hall from England. And Robert Hall wrote down on the mark sheet, he had some faults, but he said he wrote at the bottom of it that horse had the potential to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, and this horse is better than that one.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, but you know, it's so hard to find anybody that can do dressage.